Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. June 22, 2021. My new article on LinkedIn, Navigating the Maze of Communication with Our Children. What should be our approach when we communicate with our children, especially when they are young? What kind of relationships should we build with them in order to best prepare them for life? Apparently, there is a formula called grown-up equal younger, which works very well in preparing our children for life, if we use it correctly. As parents, our main goal is to build our child's personality to be ready for life, to have confidence and the ability to carry out whatever tasks our child may choose to undertake, as well as to be able to treat failures constructively and positively. To achieve this, we need to learn to relate to our children from three different perspectives, as grown-ups, as equals, as younger. Each perspective has its role and the right time to use it. The trick is to know when to use which of them and how to use them correctly. Let's begin with the grown-up perspective. Here we place ourselves above the child, as the dominant parent figure. We set the rules and apply pressure when needed. With the equal perspective, we will discover that often, the child listens to us much more attentively when we speak as equals rather than with a top-down tone. Here is when we treat children as friends, playmates, and even as confidants. When we take the younger perspective, we allow the child to practice being the mature adult, to lead and direct us. Combining the three helps children better understand the complexities of human relationships. It helps them develop the ability to adapt and adjust themselves to changing circumstances, to know how to relate to teachers, friends, and later in life, to partners and co-workers. Now that we've outlined the three perspectives, let's add some insights about each of them. When taking the younger perspective, we need to know how to do it without losing our parental authority. To do this, we need to explain to the child, with words and by example, that every person has strengths and weaknesses, that we cannot all know everything and be able to do everything. For example, even if you are an Olympic champion, you cannot be an Olympic champion in all the sports. When children learn that it's okay not to excel in everything, it takes a big load off of their young shoulders and allows them to be happy where they are, pursue the things that truly interest them, and eventually excel in them. At the same time, they will not become insecure because they don't know everything or understand everything. Concerning the equal perspective, it is important that the child will feel that we are always working in his or her best interest. Children need to know that whatever happens, even if we're mad at them or become demanding, it is because we are working in their interest, that our pressure helps them achieve what would be harder, if not impossible to achieve were it not for our pressure. It is a good idea to tell them explicitly that it pains us, that we have to reproach them and pressure them, and explain why it is for their own good. If the child does not accept our explanation, we should show how sorry we are that we have to be this way, that we are hurting together with the child, but we must do it nonetheless because it is the best thing for the child, and as parents, we must see that our children get the best rearing that will help them the most to become successful grown-ups. Sometimes, we can even admit that our demand is very difficult, that we are not sure they can handle it, but that if they do, they will benefit tremendously and it will open new doors for them. In that state, we should leave the child with space to build his or herself independently. Regarding the grown-up perspective, here the parents makes the decisions. They have to explain that sometimes, we just have to accept certain things. This may not be easy on the child, but it is a great example because when we grow up, we have to obey the law, follow the rules of the school or university we're in, the workplace, bosses, etc. If children aren't accustomed to obeying rules, even if they sometimes don't understand them or agree with them, it can be a problem for them to cope with the society they live in. Here is a real-life example and how we can use the three perspectives to turn an everyday situation from an ordeal into an experience of growth. It often takes little children a long time to get dressed, wash up, and get ready for school in the morning. This can create a lot of stress and pressure and lead to unpleasant situations. The first thing in dealing with it is to go over all the stages of the morning routine with the child, not in real time, but in your free time, when you're all relaxed. You imagine what you do every morning one step at a time and together with the child, you learn what each stage, bathroom, breakfast, getting dressed, etc., entails. You allocate, in collaboration with the child, a realistic time limit for each action, and the child will now practice keeping time instead of being passive and forced to get up. In this way, the whole process becomes a bit of a game. After a day or two, when the child knows the routine by heart, you take the younger perspective and the child becomes the grown-up. Now it's the child's turn to see that you're on time, to make sure you aren't holding him or her up. In this way, every situation in life, especially the more challenging ones, can become a learning experience that lead to personal growth and to learning new skills that will raise our children happy, confident, and able to communicate successfully with the people around them. Michael Leitman, on Quora, does the world produce enough food to feed everyone? Indeed, the world produces enough food to feed everyone, but the problem is that we cannot divide it correctly, genuinely and fairly. Our ego does not let us distribute products well and correctly, equally for everyone. Food is thrown out in some places of the world, while in other places, people starve to death. Such is our nature, and it will not change until we reach the conclusion that we need to change our nature from egoistic to altruistic. Until we do, the situation in the world will also not change, and the polarization in the world will become more and more diametric. We can expect to see a sharper division of the world into some places where people starve to death, and others where people discard of excess food. The problem with changing our nature from egoistic to altruistic is that we cannot overcome the ego while we remain in our ordinary boundaries. In order to undergo this transformation, we need to discover the law of nature, which is a law of love and altruism, in our human relations. By seeing that nature acts this way, we will also be able to change ourselves in order to prevent self-annihilation. Everyone will then discover how to realize our global interdependence and interconnectedness harmoniously, and we will be able to divide all products equally, so they will be balanced among everyone. Based on a Q&A with Kabbalist Dr. Michael Leitman on September 9, 2006. Written, edited by students of Kabbalist Dr. Michael Leitman. New Life 1309. Communication with small kids in the family.
Hello and thanks for joining us on the New Life Show, Dr. Michael Leitman. Hello, Dr. Leitman.
Hello to all.
Hello, Yael. Hello. And today we would like to talk to Dr. Leitman about communication within the family between parents and younger children up to the age of 10. Suppose we know anyone has children, that these are critical ages where the communication that we have with our children at that time influences them further in life and also us. And we'll try to learn a few interesting new things. Be with us. Yael, please. So, today we'd really like to focus on the nucleus family, where there are children from the ages of 3 through 5, 8, for example, and the communication with the parents is, we as parents We feel great responsibility. It's an age during which the child is truly formed. And first of all, we don't understand. What does he understand at what age? So we don't know what to tell him. What messages can we convey and when and what to say and how? And the other thing is that eventually we want to build a human being. And on this show, we'd like to talk about a person who knows how to have proper communication, both inside the family and later on outside of the family. Because the family is only a kind of incubator from which she later on comes out into life. And we'd like to learn about the communication aspect between parents and children at these ages. And before we begin, we'd like to look at things a bit more broadly in terms of what should be the inner approach of a parent toward the child. Why am I the parent of these children? What is the meaning of the connection between us, parents and children? This on the broader level before we turn to the more practical communication, if you can give us a broader outlook.
You have to guide me a little more precisely.
What should be a parent's inner approach, attitude toward his child? Why am I his child? What is my role in this?
You need to form him, to shape him in life, to format him. You have to position him into a direction that you think is correct. Who else other than you chooses in such ages the path, the direction for the child, how much he progresses, to which direction, what will come out of it? You even think what comes out of it, what profession, what is the image that he's going to have when he grows up. And according to that, even though you're not very conscious of it, you face him towards that image. You direct him, you push him towards that.
And what is the connection, the meaning of the connection between us?
That you obligate him, the child, to make several steps towards that direction that you think he should advance to.
So this happens through our connection, meaning it's eventually my way to shape him and format him, as you said, into who I think he should be. And what is the right kind of connection between a parent and their child?
The right form between friends and parents and children. But friends can be, in many cases, more beneficial. The child will hear more if we relate to him as his friends.
When you're saying parents and children, you mean more in the way of hierarchy. And this kind of attitude of friendship towards a child from what age?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you see that you can influence him better for him to feel in you a friend, then it's more beneficial to be a friend.
Are there children that it's hard to influence them as a friend, but only hierarchy can help?
Depends on the personality of the child and the general atmosphere in the family. But we have to use both.
What's the proper atmosphere that we should create in the family in order to be a cell that correctly raises our children?
We have to understand, and here is the challenge, a big challenge. When do we relate that when we are equal or lower than the child, or when we are higher than him, bigger than him? All of these options have a place.
And a parent actually has to control all these options and to know when to do what.
And of course, we have to teach the parent to be a parent.
Maybe you can explain in a few words about each of these levels. You said that we have to know when to relate to the child as though we're under him and he's above us, when at the same, on the same level, and when are we above him? If you can elaborate.
It depends on the ages. But in those ages of 0 to 10, until 10, there is such wide gaps here between outlooks on the child and his grasp, his attitude and relation.
Even without specifically relating to a certain age, but even before, I, as a parent, direct me. When I look, I have children. I start raising them. A few words about the three different types of attitude. Can you elaborate a bit? You said that sometimes I have to relate to the child as though I'm under him, beneath him. Sometimes we're on the same level, and sometimes I'm above.
It seems to me like it's obvious. If I am, if I am like a friend with a child, then I have to pay attention more about how much we are in common play, in conversation, in mutual understanding. If I'm above him, then I'm more directive, I'm more pressing, and he needs to understand and know how to receive this from me. If he would have later an opportunity to accept such position from somebody else. And I'm giving the child an opportunity to direct me, to play with me, to lead, and I'm following after him. All of these situations we have to mix up depending on the situation. But the child needs to understand that there is place for such relations.
And what does that build in a child, these three forms?
He understands relations, human relations better. He finds in himself room to adjust himself properly, how to relate to others accordingly. And it gives him a wide range of development.
I understand he's just a result, but I, as a parent, is it important for me to be flexible and dynamic?
Yes, of course, of course. Mothers are more successful in that because they have flexibility and inner preparedness, because for them, the child is their prize, and they're willing to do, to position themselves on the side for the child.
And what about us?
And for us, it's more challenging. We aren't as flexible, and we don't really want it and need it. To begin with, we have an approach, almost like a military approach, so to speak. It isn't always good. Although without it, we also can't.
So you're saying that a man is more inclined to look at things at the child from above, and is less inclined toward being a friend, and less in the direction of the child teaching him what's right. But these three are significant, these three states.
There is a great importance, and men aren't as flexible.
I want to ask why I, as a father, why am I the father of this specific child?
That you need to understand the root of your soul and what corrections you need to make in your life. And part of your corrections, they are passed on to the child.
So this relationship is actually a kind of means for correction?
For the correction of the soul.
For both sides.
Meaning, yes.
The child being my father or daughter, or my son or daughter, it's not just by chance.
No, no, no. There is no chance here at all. It's a continuation of the soul.
Is there an advantage? We talked about these three states of above, equality, and from under, from below. Can you describe situations where it is more correct to use one or the other? Why am I asking? Because there are people that really, they're just in one position. Either they relate to their child as their friend, and then the child lacks the other types of attitude, or there's no hierarchy, and then something else is lacking. I'm not familiar with someone who only learns from his child, but you know, usually we're either here or there, but we should use all three. So if you can focus us, in what states should parents relate in one way, and in what states another?
I don't think there is an opportunity to guide a person, either a man or a woman. It's one. Rather, if we understand what is in front of us, how much we want to see the child successful, we can always depict before us what is missing that we can give him in every moment towards his development. And I don't think that we would be wrong if we balance ourselves correctly with love and responsibility and understanding of where we are in relation to the care for the child.
You say that if we want to see a successful child and we'll envision every moment out of love and responsibility what's lacking, we'll know what attitude to choose, above, equal, or below. Now, a successful child, I understand that that's the goal in light of which I have to, toward which I have to measure every time my attitude. An image of a successful child, what is that? How do I depict that? Every child's different, but still, there's probably some kind of prototype of a successful child. What is it?
It's a balanced child. That doesn't break into bad or good, who understands where he is. Maybe he seems a little more mature than his age. But it is from the habit that this is how he relates to life and feels life that influences him. And he has this constant communication between him and life. And we see such children that they are a little more secluded. They seclude themselves from others. Not necessarily in play or in the classroom, but they have something that they are a little bit more, they're more different, they're a little more mature than other children.
And don't you kind of lose your childhood in that?
No. There is nothing to fear of that.
I'd like to raise a few more questions we got from our online viewers. The first question is, why is it important to give the child the opportunity to teach the parent in relation to this attitude that sometimes I have to be under him and to allow him to teach me? Will it not cause the loss of my authority as a parent?
It's possible that it won't. I need to explain to him that there are such situations in life in which I don't understand them. I'm not familiar with them. And I'm not afraid to explain this to the child, that I am not familiar with these situations. It is not my profession. I feel myself weak in that. However, I explain it to him in such a way that there is no deficiency in that, no deficit, that in his life will also be a lot of situations that he will not be able to be a champion in all of the different sports, it's clear. However, each in his place, how much he needs, however much he needs for life, to be confident in what he does, to defend himself, to receive his proper place in life, in society.
That's beautiful. You just said that when I relate to him in a certain way, I have to take into account that I'm teaching him what is he going to stumble upon in life that sometimes he won't know and understand and be the smartest. So can we say that it's a general principle that when I relate to my child, I have to take into account that now I'm building in him his future attitude and approaches to life?
Yeah.
What do you do with this responsibility that you're like putting on my shoulders some heavy weight? I have to all the time, it should be like here at the back of my head all the time, that the way I relate to him, I shape him, I this, I that. Meaning to be a parent.
Aha. No, sof, sof.
Ah, no, finally.
Another question about being friends. The first approach you describe was being friends. What does it mean to be like friends? What is that like?
It is for the child to feel that you are doing this, whatever it may be, for his benefit. Even when you press on him and obligate him, it's for his benefit. You even need to tell him in a clear fashion that I am really sorry that I have to press on you and demand of you, but you have to reach this and that.
It's really important what you're saying now, because the child's initial instinct is, if he feels that it's inconvenient or something that he doesn't want to do, then the feeling is that it's against him and not to his benefit. So one way is to say that even though that it seems to you like this and like that, you should know that really I'm doing it to your benefit. Are there other ways by which I can cause him to feel that I'm really in his favor always?
We have to explain that this is the world and this is our life. All in all, I'm teaching him how to be more prepared for all of those stresses and relations that he will have in life.
From what age can a child understand that?
I believe from a fairly young age, from the age of 5 at least, they remember things.
Another question. You said that it's very important to give him an example of how to overcome my pride, how to get help from someone, how to cooperate. This guidance, it's really critical for his ability to communicate in the future with the people around him.
Yeah, let's say, how do I say, let's see, that I speak in the presence of my child that I have to meet with someone, and I can say that how challenging it is for me to speak to him, how I can't stand that person, and along with it, I prepare myself correctly to speak kindly to this person, to try to be correct.
You're really exposing him to your inner world, all the contemplations that you have.
All of the education is only from example. Only from example.
Is it important for him to also come with me to different places, to see me relating, interacting with other people, not only in the family?
It's good for a child, depending on what age, but I think from 6, 7, it's very beneficial.
One more thing. You said that even when I have to relate to the child in some more rigid way, I have to be a bit tougher. I have to explain that it's to your benefit. I'm sorry, but I have no other choice. This is to your benefit. So the question is, even though that I tell him that it's to his benefit, he doesn't accept it. As a parent, what am I supposed to do about it?
So I show him how much I'm sorry together with him. That I'm also in the same stress and pressure and the same situation as he is. And even I tell him, I don't know how you will be able to overcome that. In my eyes, it's very challenging. But if you're able to overcome this, you will be a hero. Meaning that I in advance tell him that it's not a simple thing, and maybe he will not be successful. And that's why I only give him the opportunity. Try. If it really is within reach, and if you're successful, it will open before you gates.
When you were talking, I got this feeling that whenever you turn to your child, you leave lots of room for him.
Yes, of course. I don't press on him and try to mold him into anything that I do. I give him the opportunity to exist in such a way and build himself.
Even when you're in this attitude of from above down,
in the attitude from above downwards, I explain it to him as well, but I also say that there are such things in life that we have to accept without any choice. And it's not my attitude that comes from above down to him, but these are the rules of the society. The upper force, let's say, that it obligates, however it obligates us, we have to receive it.
Every word that you say increases this feeling in me that what we started out with is communication, the family with children. When there's communication, there are two sides, you and me, and the communication between us. And the more we talk, I feel that you're taking me, the parent, and the child, and you're moving us to the same side. We're together. It's not that I'm communicating with you in one way or another, but together we're going through something from which both of us are learning and are developing. That's how it is.
That's very true. I don't position myself against him. The opposite. We are together.
It
sounds beautiful. And I'd like to give a short example. You know, it's evening, you have to shower, organize themselves for the next day, and it's like one of the things that you have to do. You can't choose. You have to get to school the next day, and you have to leave at a certain time. So how do you correctly deal with the child's resistance to leave home, and I'm in a rush, I have to get to work, and he doesn't want to get up? What do I do? How to still be on the same side where, just by talking about the situation, I feel on both sides.
That he has to leave together with you?
Yeah, he has to get to kindergarten, for example, and I have to get to work.
So he has to be prepared.
Right.
So he has clothes that he has to wear. He has a big clock that he sees that presses on him, and that he knows what time you have to leave. He understands the time and is familiar with the time, yes?
And
what happens?
Well, you know, suddenly I don't feel like it, he says, or there's something that catches his attention, he wants to continue playing. Also, for me, it's hard to leave on time in the morning, but as an adult, I make all the efforts to do it. But he has a smaller responsibility than I do, so how do I force him when he doesn't want to come? How do I even make him my partner in this? Because in many families, it's a point of, it's material for a fight, and you leave all edgy.
We have to do exercises in which we learn how every minute in the morning, we go through like soldiers. In that minute, I get dressed. In that minute, I am already putting my shoes on. In this minute, I'm done with the bathroom. In this minute here, I put together my backpack. All of this according to the minutes. And the minute before we have agreed, I already stand before the door and wait for mom.
So we have to agree on it in advance. We have to exercise, prepare ourselves for it.
The child needs to understand and know that 5 minutes before leaving the house, he understands the clock and he yells for mom, "Mom, we are leaving in 5 minutes."
It's possible
for him to know that he's responsible, otherwise mom would not be able to leave on time.
So to pass the responsibility onto him.
Of course, so that a minute before leaving, he feels himself as a master.
That's beautiful. Unfortunately, our time's up, but what should we keep in mind so that the communication with our children will be great?
To do with him the entire program, the plan, in cooperation, so that through cooperation he understands that this is how life is built, and precisely through that we are successful.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lightman. Thank you, Yael. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.
My new article on LinkedIn, "Can Hamas Not Hate Israel?" In a recent video that was posted on my Facebook page in Hebrew, I said that if we connect with one another in Israel, Hamas will not only make peace with us, but will also come and help us. The video, as would be expected, got many comments. The interesting part about them was that it got comments from both Jews and Arabs. The comments from the Jews were mainly that it was unrealistic, that we have always been hated and we'll always be hated. The comments from the Arabs, however, were mainly praises for the truthful words I said, and encouragement to continue speaking about it. While we weren't always hated, as some of the comments claimed, we have indeed been hated for the past 2 millennia, since the ruin of the Second Temple. But then, the temple was ruined, and the Romans exiled us, precisely because of our hatred for each other. Read every Jewish text on the subject and it will tell you that the only reason that this catastrophe came upon us was our own hatred for each other. Since the ruin of the temple, we have not healed the hatred that splintered us, and history shows that whenever Jews became more belligerent toward each other, antisemitism intensified. While it is true that since the ruin of the temple, there has not been a time without antisemitism, it is just as true that since that time, there has not been a day when we did not hate each other. Prior to the ruin of the temple, we did have brief periods of unity, and those were our most glorious days. When we united under Joseph in Egypt, we were given the land of Goshen, Egypt's most fertile stretch of land. When Joseph died, we broke apart and the Egyptians began to hate us. When we reunited under Moses, we were liberated from Egypt and received our code of law, the Torah, of which the most fundamental tenet is love your neighbor as yourself, Lev. 19:18. In Israel, we began to part once more and lost the land to the Babylonians. In the exile in Babylon, we united once again because of Haman's intention to annihilate the Jews. A short while later, we received the Cyrus Declaration, which sent us back to the land of Israel with the king's blessings, the treasures of the first temple, provisions for the journey, and the king's support in building the second temple. While we were united in Judea, the nations came to learn from us the wisdom of unity. The Torah was translated into Greek, and people from all the nations came every pilgrimage to Jerusalem to watch the miracle of Jewish unity. Then we lost our unity once more when many in the nation adopted Hellenism. A civil war broke out. When the united Hasmoneans won the war, the mighty Seleucid Empire reinstated our freedom. But that unity was very fragile and short-lived. The next time we fell into internal hatred, we did not recover from it. As a result, the Romans conquered the land and finally drove us out. Since then, we have not recovered from the internal hatred, and since then, there has not been a time without anti-Semitism. To understand why our hatred for each other makes the world hate us, we must remember that our ancestors came from precisely those nations that hate us, now, meaning from the rest of the world. Our ancestors came from all the nations and united into a nation only when those complete strangers heard Abraham's message of unity and implemented it with one another, with those people around them, who believed in the novel idea of unity of all nations. Abraham taught his ideas to his successors, who continued to develop it until, under our greatest teacher, Moses, we vowed to reach the ultimate level of unity and be as one man with one heart. The code of law that we received at that time, the Torah, was to help us realize our vow to become a virtuous people, a light unto nations. In this way, people who were originally hateful of each other became bonded at the hearts. Through our own society, we demonstrated that peace among the nations was achievable. We presented an alternative to the enmity that ruled the world until then. This is why the nations loved us, while we loved each other. These days, when the world is quickly sinking into intensifying hatred, humanity desperately needs a solution that will save it from a third world war. Instinctively, the nations look to the people who presented an alternative before, to present the alternative once more. But what do they see? They see the same hatred that has plagued our people for the past two millennia. This leaves the world without help for a peaceful solution to its problems, since the agents of the solution are not carrying out their duty. The world wishes that we did, but we are not, so how can it not hate us? The state of Israel is an opportunity for the Jewish people to do its task, to unite and be a light unto nations. This is why if we unite, everyone will love us, as they did before. If we hate one another, as we do today, everyone will continue to hate us, and will seek to get rid of us. For more on this topic, refer to the books The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism, Historical Facts on Anti-Semitism as a Reflection of Jewish Social Discord, and Like a Bundle of Reeds, Why Unity and Mutual Guarantee are Today's Call of the Hour. Europe can no longer be saved. Question. Europe is on the verge of a new migration crisis. They say that such a horror has not been for a long time. Africa is storming European borders, mostly from the sea. For $1,800, you can get from Libya to Italy. From West Africa, you can get to Spain. There are three times as many migrants there as during the entire previous year. And all this is because Europe still does not have a systematic approach to the issue of immigrants. Either Europe will be washed away by a young wave from Africa, or Europe will conduct a real integration of migrants into its environment. What should be done? What is your opinion? Answer: these countries will soon be almost gone. Neither Italy, nor Spain, nor the entire coast, including the Côte d'Azur, Greece, and so on. The entire strip will be populated by immigrants from Africa. Comment: they say that this is all because there was no systematic approach to the reception of immigrants. My response: they can't come to an agreement. It's the United Countries of Europe. They can't unite. They only call themselves that. Question: do you think it's useless to twitch anymore? Or can something be done? Answer: I don't know. But this democracy leads to the fact that you do not have the strength and no opportunity to knock on the table and say, this will work so and so. There is no person who can do it, no government that can do it, because everything is disconnected, everything is like a chagrin skin falling apart. So, I don't see a future. All the same, migrants will crawl through all the holes, they will still capture, they will still occupy, and they will demand some benefits and special treatment. And Europe will give up. Question: that is, such a boomerang is happening now. You have captured us, and now we return to you with this gift. But is it still possible to somehow fit them into society, to dilute the cultures? Will children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren be able to accept European culture? Answer: immigrants have been in Europe for 20 years. If we are talking about people from Africa, then they have no need to integrate into European culture. They are closer to the Arab culture. Question: and if you had the opportunity to offer something and you were heard, what would you say? At least a few tips? Answer: my advice is very simple, and it is for everyone and always. It all depends on the upbringing. We must definitely think carefully about the system of education that would make all the people on Earth real people. We are one single organism, we are completely dependent on each other. We can't run away from this. We must attract an upper force to unite us, and not point out to it that it divides us. Question: so the basis of the education system is what you are saying now? A single organism? Answer: yes. And only in this. You don't need any physics, mathematics, philosophy, or anything else. It doesn't do anything. The only thing we need, that we all come from one single root. And then all this will gradually be accepted by everyone. This is a perennial system that must enter humanity. Question: should there be a leader who will start this long educational process, so that grandchildren and great-grandchildren suddenly enter this state, which is called a single organism, a single nation? Answer: yes. But can you imagine what kind of program they should develop today and how to implement it against what is already there? Question: but is it possible at least? The sensation is that it's impossible. Answer: we always say that the upper force should do everything. The main thing is for a person to tune in, and then it will come from above. From CAB TV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, May 27, 2021. Explore the land of your desires. The Prophets, Joshua, chapter 2, 23-24, and the two men returned and descended from the mountain, and crossed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and told him all that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, for the Lord has delivered into our hands all the land, and also the inhabitants of the country have melted away because of us. In principle, it is already known in advance that the city will be taken, that is, all the desires that are outside the city wall will eventually submit to the property of bestowal. Question: why was it necessary to send spies there to get evidence? After all, everything was clear already. Answer: no. A person should move forward knowing where he is going and why he is doing it. People should feel all their properties, which of them they can advance with, how much they should change their egoism, deal with each other, rise above the ego, connect together. Only in this way do they gain a new space, a new desire. When they unite with each other, they must spread into more and more new desires until the property of bestowal and love will cover the entire globe. From CAB TV's Secrets of the Eternal Book, June 11, 2021. Treatment with the meaning of life. Question: people who turn to psychotherapists for the most part believe that they are losing the meaning of life. Therefore, in psychotherapy there is a whole branch of methods in which all kinds of religious dogmas, theories, and insights are very actively involved. The well-known psychotherapist Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor who was imprisoned in a concentration camp, treated many people there and gave them the feeling that everyone's life has some purpose. By redirecting this vector in the right direction, a person suddenly comes to life even in the most terrible conditions. What is your opinion on therapy with the meaning of life? Answer: I do not know what criteria you use in order to convince a person that there is meaning in his life. Religion speaks of the meaning of suffering in the following way: here you will suffer, there you will receive a reward. And Kabbalah says that a person must rise to such a level during his lifetime, and this fits every person, in order to feel and understand that all suffering is not suffering at all, meaning that we transform them into pleasures. Naturally, this depends on our point of view. We understand that all this is psychology and nothing more. Kabbalah does not belong to religions. It does not name some special higher powers, but real forces of nature. It names the highest forces of nature the creator of nature, the crown of nature, etc., but nothing more, without attributing any dogmas or anything else. That is, everything is inside a person. This attitude does not depend on any confessions or nationalities. All that is needed is the desire of a person and the influence of the right team on him. First, you need to create such an environment and slowly, using it as a laboratory, as a test bench, introduce people there. And the team will process them correctly. It is possible. Moreover, it is a very fast and relatively easy technique. We know the strength of the influence of the environment on a person. It has been sufficiently studied, and everyone uses it, from secret government services to everyone else, both at school and everywhere. From CAB TV's Kabbalah and Psychology. In contradiction with the laws of the land of Israel. Question: the five books of the Torah tell the story before entering the land of Israel. Does this mean they only talk about rising above egoism and not about working on it itself? Is it about the law, "Do not do unto others what you would not like others to do unto yourself"? Answer: yes. There was no question of love here because it can only be in the land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael. Eretz is desire, Ratzon, Yisrael directly to the Creator. Therefore, the law "do not do unto others what you would not like others to do unto you" was passed by the people together with Moses before entering Israel. There are a lot of laws that we need to accept in order to be in the correct interaction with each other. And there are laws that you need to start following when you entered the land of Israel. But now we are not even in non-fulfillment, but in complete contradiction with the laws of the land of Israel. Question: why is the spring compressed so that we do not even follow the elementary laws? Answer: in order for us to realize that we are in the state opposite to what we want. From CAB TV's Secrets of the Eternal Book, May 19, 2021. A difficult path of disseminating the wisdom of Kabbalah. Comment: Baal HaSulam went beyond the framework of the generally recognized Kabbalist by engaging in wide public activities. He met with public figures and wrote articles that no Kabbalist had written before. My response: Baal HaSulam tried to advertise, disseminate, and spread the wisdom of Kabbalah in any way possible. He met with many other Kabbalists, scientists, statesmen, and ordinary people. He traveled to Poland during the May Day demonstrations to somehow use the enthusiasm of the Polish workers and to tell them what they could bring to our world and how to change their lives with the help of the wisdom of Kabbalah. Generally speaking, he did everything in his power to disseminate the wisdom of Kabbalah. Rabash was much more modest and on a much lower level. He lived in a time when there was already a great force of resistance and so, to put it bluntly, he did not really go wild. I grew up by his side, and I saw how limited his actions were. When he passed away, I continued his legacy and have set for myself the goal to disseminate the idea of the wisdom of Kabbalah as much as possible in every language and all over the world, on the internet and wherever possible, without paying attention to any opposition I might encounter. Even if the whole world curses me, I will still do it. Thus, despite the world's resistance, I am still here. Comment: but on the other hand, Rabash was still a great revolutionary like his father. He accepted 40 totally non-religious students. My response: yes, yet he did gently, not so harshly. It was a great leap forward. From CAB TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, March 10, 2019.